Odprti termin Radio Študent.
Dobar večer, še v odprtem terminu za kulturo, kjer bomo danes v naslednji uri se ukvarjali, ja, smrtjo. Ukvarjali se bomo smrtjo in sicer nekako precepo med politiko, teorijo in pa tudi glasbo. In sicer povod za tole vdajo je bil obisk bolgarskega filozofa Stanimirja Panajotova. Pred časom se je mudil v Gleju. Tam je v bistvu skupaj z režiserjem Mladenom Aleksejevem in pa Markom Bratušem pripravljal nekakšno miniaturko, ki je izhajala, bolj in manj izhajala iz tako imenovane nekropolitike. To je tudi nekakšna štartna točka, s katere se bomo potopili danes v, bolj ali manj, recimo temu, darkerske vode. Zdaj za začetek bi nekako poslušalke in poslušalce prosil za malo potrpožljivosti, kaj ti poslušali bomo en tak desetminuten teoretičen kos, ki je pač, s katerim je Panajotov zaključil svoje predavanje v Gleju. To je predavanje, ki se je imenovalo Neonekronomikom ponavljanja smrti za sebe. Zdaj, zakaj gre? V bistvu je Stanimir odpredaval svoj esej o knjigi Marine Gržinič in Šefika Tatliča. To je knjiga Nekropolitika, rasnost in globalni kapitalizem, zgodovinjenje biopolitike in forenzike politike, umetnosti in življenje. Knjiga je šla, mislim, da kakšno leto nazaj v angleščini in Stanimir Panajotov je napisal eno recenzijo, v bistvu esej, kjer je nekako ne samo recenziral to knjigo, ampak tudi razvil nekaj stvari naprej in to je tudi predstavil v Gleju. Več o tem, o sami današnji vdaji, pa zakaj je do nje prišlo in tako naprej kasneje, zdaj pa nekako poslušimo tale sklep tega predavanja, kjer v bistvu Panajotov razvija tezo ponavljanja smrti za sebe in kot je nekako verjetno že tudi vidno iz same formulacije smrti za sebe, se nekropolitike, današnjega stanja nekropolitike loti predvsem preko Hegla, preko Heglove logike. Tako da ja, poslušimo tale teoretičen kos, pa se slišimo še potem.
Repetition is the new image of the law of the dead. The reduction of Western model liberal capitalist democracies imitates biopolitics and thus proposes a new imagery of life that has nothing to do with commonality. But this move is not only an image. It is an image of a law, the law of the market. The new image of the law of the dead is literally, so I unpack Neonekronomikon in the following way, the biopolitical image of the market of the dead. And this image is precisely an image. It is a false representation, a false image of necropolitics. The new image of the law of the dead is then a repetition for its own sake. It is repetition for itself. For what can there be beyond the law of the market of the dead? What can be outside of it? So let me clarify what this means in the tripartite division of the idea in Hegel's logic, the big logic, not the small logic. So there are three stages there, and I want to just clarify them to clarify myself what I mean by repetition of dead for itself a little bit. So with Hegel, you have three stages of the unfolding of the absolute idea. First, there is the in itself, then is the for itself, and the third stage of the absolute idea would be the in and for itself. know, thesis, antithesis, synthesis, a typical Hegelian structure. In the first stage, the Hegelian in itself is basically, it's an underdeveloped state of the idea and the phenomenon, and it's still in concealment. It's not manifested. The second stage, the for itself, which concerns me, is a thing developed to the point where it has consciousness of itself. So I propose this idea of repetition of that for itself as a stage where necropolitical regimes have consciousness of themselves. In society, this corresponds to a movement in which the individuals know and identify themselves as part of that movement and have a shared program, be it a social, cultural, whatever program. However, consciousness has here lost its content. It now has consciousness and purpose, means and ends, but there is a lack of correspondence between means and ends. That the neonacronomicon, as I call it, is a repetition of that for itself, if it is indeed that, indicates, in my opinion, that the means and ends have, in this second stage of for itself, have merged to the state of the absolute idea. And this is bad, because this happens in the third stage in Hegel. It happens in the third stage of the in and for itself. But what this truly means for the second stage of for itself is that if this is indeed the case, the triadic Hegelian structure cannot be really achieved. As in this case, we cannot proceed to the final stage, which is the original term of the absolute idea. And we cannot do that because the case is no longer that there is no correspondence between means and end in the second stage of the for itself, or in this case we can say not only means and ends but also form and content. But because there is an absolute correspondence of these, necropolitics has developed at this second stage a consciousness of itself, but it has no corresponding being. And it has no corresponding being because it conceals itself under biopolitics. This is especially the case, as it's made clear in the book, for Western liberal capitalist societies. Necropolitics has developed at this stage a consciousness of itself, but it has no corresponding being. For necropolitics to have being, it has to have a referent outside it, literally a life, but it doesn't have it. And in order for the in and for itself to be the third stage, this identity of idea and being should be achieved. But under the neo-necronomicon, it cannot be achieved because the identity of consciousness as being is impossible. And it is impossible because there is a correspondence of means and end at the wrong stage, the second stage, if we follow Hegel through. And then, secondly, because of the identity that I discussed previously of reality is reality, which is the formula that Kirchhoff offers. And reality is true, it's a true formula that describes the state of affairs, as necropolitics is covered under the guise of biopolitics. And because the third stage in history and society is like a social movement that has achieved its objective and merged itself into the whole social body, for example, like the women's movement on the day that the oppression of women no longer exists, this means that necropolitics has become an automation of identity without being, without life, or even bad life, not to mention good life. So this absolute crippled identity has profound consequences for all spheres of life, including arts and culture. Furthermore, let us speculate that the neo-necronomicon is a transcendental notion. Again, something that is entirely outside. I'm just simplifying what transcendental means. It's a transcendental notion of the politics of death. This means that by proposing a flat ontology of reality, which repetition does, since it empties the identity through the formula reality is reality, and it becomes a universal placeholder of reality, the necropolitical repetition of life itself no longer has life as its model and content. This is why when the neo-necronomicon is continually repeated, it might be devoid of any image, a apparently so, but it contains all possible images that represent so-called life in Western biopolitical societies of control, which live under the pretense that necropolitics is not applicable on their ground. And since the neo-necronomicon serves as a meta-image of the dead, of the law of the dead, it has to be posited as something transcendental. So again, a transcendental politics of death. And this means that it is not of the order of this world, it's otherworldly, that it order, but it still orders our reality, and our reality is reality, like a godlike law. And at this point, this is not even the Leviathan or the market, it's something else. At this point, the deified transcendental law of the neo-necronomicon is really the logic of repetition, which is the new monster of political theology. Almost as in the fictional Lovecraftian mad Arab. Here we have a real mad European who becomes fictional in as much as he is transcendental. But the effect of the neo-necronomicon is also aesthetic. What are the consequences then, really, for the artistic imaginaries that we can use and have? Because we have some. This means that, for me, I will speculate, this is my speculative conclusion, this means that whatever forms of art and cultural resistance we engage in, not to mention social movements and social resistance, they are driven by the desire of aestheticization of reality, according to the logic of a reproduction of reality is reality, and not according to the logic of simply reality. Because if it was simply reality, then we can introduce some sort of neutralizing asymmetry, something that will defer reality from itself. So we are stuck in the for itself, in the second stage. We are stuck in the for itself and repeating that for itself, also in the field of culture and arts. In this case, the world of artistic expression and representation becomes itself a necrosystem. Unwillingly so, but it could become such a system. It becomes a tyrannic ecology of always already dead ideas, simply because they do not refer to anything in this world which is not always already transcendental. And anything which is an art preference is transcendental if the form has already eaten the contents, as Gurdjieff seems to show us in her analysis. For the content to be expressive of something other than the represented reality, it has to differentiate reality by way of some sort of asymmetry, as I tried to say earlier, by something which is unnatural or otherworldly. And I think that whether we call it neo-necronomicon or repetition for itself as a contracted formula of that, I think this is impossible. So we cannot go back under a necropolitical regime of using these artistic expressions to recuperate the sense of reality which is not the neoliberal sense of reality. And I conclude with the idea that this is probably not impossible, but almost impossible.
Takole nekako zanalašč smo padli tako rekoč na sredino pojma nekropolitike, pojma, ki je sicer že kar nekaj časa v teoretskem obtoku, ne toliko recimo v neki vsakodnevni govorici, ampak teorije pa kar gre za pojem, ki ga je pred časom razvil Chilembembe in ki nekako v nasprotju z biopolitiko, če najbolj strnem, regulira populacijo preko smrti. Se pravi, ne več preko življenja, ampak preko smrti. Zdaj, dolžen sem še nekaj podatkov v samem Stanimirju Panajotovu, pa tudi zakaj nekako sem spravil to oddajo danes skup. Ko sem prebral, da prihaja na obisk Stanimir Panajotov, me je med navedki njegovih interesov, med katere pač gre za dokaj mladega filozofa, starega, mislim, da tam kakšnih 35 let, ki se ukvarja z neoplatonizmom, novimi materializmi, spekulativnim realizmom in tako naprej in tako naprej. Dejansko ful teh stvari je naštetih. No, nekak mi je padlo oči tudi to, da piše o teoriji black metala oziroma da recenzira tudi glasbo black metala Drona in pa Duma in pa Doom metala. To je nekako zbudil moj interes, zato sem s Tajanim Mirjem opravil en kratek intervju in da ne bi bilo vse tako klasično, sem se nekako odločil, ker sem v tem intervjuju nekako tudi težil s tem, da bi povezali njegovo ukvarjanje z nekropolitiko oziroma z današnjim stanjem nekropolitike in pa na drugi strani kulturnimi, umetniškimi, zvočnimi oblikami, ki nekako gravitirajo okoli tega, kar imenujemo nekro, kar dejansko so predvsem že omenjeni Black Drone, Doom in kar je še podobno zvočnih in glasbenih izrazov. V glavnem odločil sem se, da bomo v nadaljevanju poslušali izseke iz intervjuja in nekako to navezavo na te glasbene, umetniške, kulturne oblike predvsem poslušali. Torej, kar sledi, so izseke iz intervjuja s Tanimirjem Panajotovom in pa glasbeni zbor, kateremu so botrovale določene omembe na enem pogovoru neke bende samo omenil in sem jih potem vrstil na tole listo, ki bo sledila. Bi pa dal še en disclaimer, da v bistvu ne gre za nobeno reprezentacijo določenega polja, bolj za nek, bom rekel, skop nabor bolj znanih izvajalcev znotraj tega zvočnega glasbenega polja, v katerem bomo v nadaljevanju gravitirali.
The essay and also the lecture yesterday, they were deliberately fatalistic. Also because I just took the tone, the sort of ritualistic tone within the book of Grzynch and Tatlich, so I emulated it because I wanted to follow what's happening in the book also. You know, on a rhetorical level. So, and there is also the aspect that I like speculation. I practice speculative philosophy most of the time. So I just want to make clear, you know, that when if something sounds too fatalistic or too much of a deadlock, this is not necessarily a correct representation of reality. So I just believe in this. I don't believe in the rhetorical representation of reality to begin with. So I mean, I push further deliberately certain points to an extreme to make a point. But I don't have the pretension that I represent something in a positivistic kind of way. And when it comes to question of having more analysis of that rather than ideas how to have a good life under what would be then biopolitics. I think in my original text I included a list of references briefly where I actually pointed at such kind of analysis, and I listed several. So I was just trying to put in context the book of Gershwin and Tatlich, which was the basis of my lecture with other literature, which is not obviously connected to what they do, and the other way around. And one of the things that I did was I included the things that I know. I included Banu Bargu, who is a Turkish-American scholar, for example. She works on the prison industrial complex and self-immolation as a form of protest, for example. This is one case of, and already there are such analyses. So I didn't mean to just say there should be people who should do that. There are people who are doing that. I also included Richard Seymour, who's a British journalist come philosopher, who has a book which is called The Liberal Defense of Death, where he makes a sort of history of, you know, how liberalism was in favor from the get-go of something that is resembling necropolitics. And I also, I think, included the most important one would be Grégoire Chamaillu, who's a young French philosopher who works on drones and the role of drones in contemporary warfare. And I think this is the most like fleshy and understandable example of such analysis of that. That I think are important, but clearly there are other forms of analysis of that that should be privileged and singled out, especially if you wanna situate this in a certain geopolitical context, Central and Eastern Europe or Latin America or Central or Northern Africa, etc., etc. So these things are on the one hand very specific, on the other hand there is a larger global phenomenon which calls for analysis of that. And the problem with this is that it's purely intuitively, I guess it's seen as a regressive analytical step, because it seems like why should we do this analysis of dying, of these specific instances of, you know, what Hillel Mbembe calls necropolitics? Why do we have to regress there? And what I tried to explain yesterday was that the only way to either return back to biopolitics, and biopolitics is not a good thing in and of itself, but still there is a value, there is a political value there, which is not to be tossed around. In order to do that, you have to first regress into the world of necropolitical management of population, because there simply isn't a way to understand how to make any form of politics that is concerned with actual human lives. If you don't know what's happening to us, so this is the call for more analysis of dying, is based on this presumption that first we have to know how the shift happened from biopolitics to necropolitics. think one of the things that are happening right now is, at least in the world of theory, this happened. It will take some time to be translated into social movements, for example. But this already happened with so-called accelerationism, with the movement of the so-called accelerationists, and some people identify as one, some people call themselves neo-rationalists, etc., where it seems that basically in this relatively small circle of theoreticians of neoliberalism, the main idea is that we don't have to try to salvage the former social democracies that made possible the biopolitical order. What has to be done is to push the capitalist acceleration of technologies further, so that capitalism crumbles under its own speed, for example. And this is, I think, in a way, an affirmation of necropolitics, because it's a call for more of the same. You know, there's this persistent phrase, more of the same, which comes from social movements, global social movements worldwide for the last almost 10 years, since 2008. So there is the persistence of more of the same, but in this case with accelerationism, there is a deliberate tactic behind it, and the tactic seeks to overcome, in a way, the necropolitical aspects of capitalistic acceleration of the technological advancement. So this is one example, but other than that, to affirm necropolitics means that it's already in the air and it's politically recognized. And I don't think this is the case, because to affirm something, people should know about it and they should be aware of it. And I don't think we are in a stage, especially in where we live in this particular part of Europe, I don't think we're in a stage where the, you know, specimen citizen or whoever, whatever kind of social classes we have, know or think of our reality as necropolitics. They might think of it as austerity, for example, but austerity is, just covers over aspects of, what different theoreticians call necropolitics. So even if you want to affirm it, to achieve a brutal sort of facing of reality, because I guess this is where you're going with your question, even if you want to do it, you first have to kind of explain to somehow try to enlighten the people that something has changed, and we are not in a biopolitical order anymore for some time. We are in a necropolitical mode of affairs. If people buy this, but to affirm it, you have to first make people aware of that. With accelerationism is different. Accelerationism is different in this context because it's a Western European, North American phenomenon, basically, and it serves a very particular purpose in the hyper advanced technological societies. And it's not even about societies, but it's about particular technological hubs. It's not even about nation states. It's about it's about people who work in London and New York. You know, it's very specific. Even though it became a global phenomenon and in the academia, at this point, still it's very particular, and it speaks to particular needs that are very classy. They speak to a very particular niche of advanced technological class that has left leaning, most of the time left leaning tendencies. Now, interesting thing is in the original text, the foundational text for necropolitics, which is called Necropolitics by Achille Mbembe, the first part of his paper, it's an article basically, the first part of his article is entirely devoted to the differences between the general economy of Bataille and the philosophy of excess and Hegel's theory of recognition and the master and slave dialectic. And the first thing he does, and it's a methodological step in the essay, is to clarify the difference between what will be a general economy in the Hegelian sense and what will be the specific kind of economy of excess in Bataille. And that's important because the main difference there is that in Bataille, like Hegel, there is no politics. There is no political consequence that entails the affirmation of life as an organic limit. So basically, in Bataille's thought, unlike the theory of recognition in Hegel, there is no need to economize the energies and flows of organic life. This is what makes a different kind of economy. What constitutes a different? It's more complicated than that. I'm just trying to simplify. This is what he takes from Bataille, and what he sees, I think, is what he sees as deployed in necropolitics, but in a very unconscious way. So it's not like somebody decided to translate Bataille in necropolitics on a political level. But he needs to make the distinction between the two as sort of two foundational types of politics that are management of life, so to speak, to show that there's been a different model in place, the Bataille model of the metaphysics of energy, that doesn't want to spare organic life from its finitude. With Hegel, you have a clear boundary where is the finitude of the slave and when is the immortality of the master. And with Bataille, it's not that. With Bataille, you have a horizon of finitude of any sort of organic life that is intertwined with some sort of political order. And the Bataillean model is oddly transposed into a necropolitical framework, but it's not, of course, the Bataille's fault or anybody's fault in this way. It's just a model of saying that these ideas can be twisted around. So Bataille's notion of inner experience, which I know, is in a way, probably since you spoke about Foucault and Foucault's commentaries on Bataille, is in a way connected with Foucault's analysis of biopolitics, in the sense that for him, what is important in what he calls the inner experience is to do away with discursive thinking and to touch the materiality of what is be the real in itself, something that you want to be in a sacred communion with. So what he calls inner experience is, he says something along the lines of, this is just the thing that is stuck in my head. He says that it's not the thought of the wind that interests me, it's the wind itself. So it's the notion, his notion of inner experience is very excessive because it does away with the pre-existing philosophical analytical framework that who has a task to begin with, and the task of this kind of discursive thinking is to capture is to capture in a cognitive framework the reality of something. And he's not interested in that, with the notion of inner experience. He's interested in capturing the reality of what is the real, precisely by defying the limitations of discursive thought. And I think this is somehow very close to Foucault's sort of personal overtones in his work. Not so much his analysis of biopolitics, actually, but you know, ideas such as they're dispersed throughout his work, such as certain puns that he have in his work. That are very subversive, such as psychiatry. The art of living is the killing of psychology, for example. You know, sort of like we need to live instead of be guided by the psychological explanations of our reality, because this strips away our reality from its organic appeal. You know, from its organic. Vividness, so to speak. So there is a way in which the notion of the inner experience defies what will be the anthropological limit that is defined by Kant. This is what I feel could be the analogy between the two. But it feels like it's not so much related with the analytical legacy of Foucault, but rather with, to the extent to which we can divorce that, but rather with Foucault's kind of personal program, because I think he had such a program to liberate theoretical knowledge from its technological burden, from its program to always immediately construct an explanation of something. So in this sense, Foucault can be read as a theoretician against the limit, also as a theoretician against the discursive horizon of a theoretical abstraction. And he says also other stuff like he likes to joke that. He wasn't so much interested in delivering the lectures in Collège de France because he necessarily wanted to convey all the knowledge he has from the archives, with which he spent so much time. But rather, he was interested in going there to intellectually seduce young boys. You know, so he has this streak of thought. In the interviews with him, you know, which reveals this excessive quality of his. You know. I think with Bataille, it's easier to speak with Bataille rather than with Foucault about something that you can call the desire for nothingness. There is something in Foucault which is very fleshy. It's very much bound to embodiment, and he's, I think, to a large extent, a thinker who enjoys embodiment. He is a thinker of pleasure, as we know. Bataille is not a thinker of pleasure. He is a thinker of the flesh, but in a different way. Because I don't know if you know, but he was a Benedictine monk. In the beginning, you know, so he's one of those. Bataille is one of those interesting French intellectuals from the first half of the French 20th century, who was religiously passionate, and he was a devout Benedictine monk, and he was not alone in that. So. A big deal of what we know about late antique philosophy also comes from French scholars who were monks, etc., etc. So he is one of those thinkers from the first half of the 20th century in France, which were immersed in immediate religious scholarly knowledge. It's just what happened with him on a personal level led him to different consequences than people like Breyer, for example, who were also very historically minded, but Breyer and the people around him, they were interested in working with theories that indeed capture embodiment, so to speak. And in this case, it was Neoplatonism. For Bataille, my impression from what I know and what I know about him personally and what I've read from Bataille, he is a thinker who has a problem with mastering the flesh, and Foucault doesn't have a problem with that, I think. And probably the last thing is that, because I think that Bataille is one of those thinkers that I've always been obsessed with. He's one of those thinkers that posit a certain correlation between desire and nothingness. He goes in directions that are extreme, in the sense that everything that he says is very often anti-vitalist, and it's in no way life affirmative, but he goes to this extreme only because of this opposition with the Hegelian general economy, that we can call the Hegelian general economy, you know, because he undermines the master-slave dialectic entirely by going to the extremes of intimate personal liberation, and the only way to subvert the Hegelian structures is to attack the body, is to attack the flesh. There is no other way. I mean, the body is finitude. It's a limit. You can only do so much with the body. You know. And I think the way he does that in the eroticism, in his novels and his prose, is mostly by attacking the body to preserve the body's excess. And at this level, there is a connection between embodiment and nothingness. And now, interestingly, I think the kind of this really miniature scene of drone and doom metal music seems obsessed with this kind of problematic. So the people who are prone to doing this kind of droney, rather philosophical ambient doom music, it seems they also have a certain intellectual luggage. So if you look at their CVs and their interviews and etc., etc., it becomes more and more obvious, you know, that these people actually read, you know, these things we're talking about. So the question is then, how do they translate it into music? It's not my work to explain how, because when I decided that I want to write about music, I decided I'm going to do it more as a writer rather than a reviewer or something else. But there is a lot of material in these mini scenes. It's relatively small. For example, if you see. If you look at the titles of Fuchisuga and Koji Haino, you can certainly see references that are either Bataillan or Roger Kaoya or Klozowski. I still have to track down some of these things. But there's something about doom and drone, the doom and drone scenes, that is very closely tied to this correlation between the desire for excess as the desire for nothingness. And you know that when you correlate the two and when you see that they are connected, what you see is that the only way to achieve excess, which is to say to sublate the Hegelian dialectic, is to push the limits of embodiment. I think the most fascinating thing about the musical expression of that is that it's oral. It's not visual. It's just for my mind, because I have this theoretical mind. For my mind, it's a challenge to think about expressing this correlation between desire and nothing via sound. And it just drives me crazy, and it's also very invigorating in a way, you know. So it's a different form of expressing this excess, this Bataillian excess of the energies of embodiment. I guess the other important thing on the, in this personal dimension of how I perceive the metal scene is, yes, I look at it at, as a sort of condensed version of a certain pessimistic contracted essences that this scene takes from late capitalist society, but it's an interesting combination of a sort of fatalistic politics that I think is, has already been present in black metal, with a personal proclivity towards certain topics that we know from German Romanticism, if you want, you know, melancholy or cosmic pessimism or self-destruction and solitude. So all these sort of romantic, in the sense of the literary tradition, romantic themes, they've always been part of this scene. So if this is the case, then the kind of metal scene that I'm interested in, it already has the sensitivity to be a commentary on certain social political issues, and because this scene and these composers, because it's mainly composers and instrumentalists, they are having, with this sensitivity, they are having the proclivity to with their music to make certain commentaries on the state of affairs nowadays. And I like this about this particular kind of music. If you look at track titles and album titles, and also the visuals of certain artists, you will see there is a lot of social sensitivity there. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they want to affirm anything politically. So, for example, Locrian have a track which is about Syrian refugees, but they don't necessarily, they're not necessarily addressing the global problem with migration. They're interested in it, but they're not interested, they claim, they're not interested in proposing anything that will address the issue. It's a largely a commentary. Or, for example, Stephen O'Malley from Sono admits that he's interested in feminism and how feminism has influenced one or two albums that he's worked on recently, but he says, I'm not interested in the politics of feminism. So there is a certain kind of distance that the scene seems to make from the practical consequences of certain social issues. And to my knowledge, because I have a research mind, this is interesting because it brings closer the kind of metal music we're discussing now. It brings it closer to the necropolitical motif in the humanities and philosophy, because of this fatalism. And so basically, there is a certain kind of fatalism and fatalistic sensitivity going on in this particular doom meets drone metal scene, and this fatalism runs through. For example, the work of Krishnichand Tatlich. So there is a way in which I think this fatalistic sensitivity is, yes, it is an affirmation of necropolitical motives, if you will, within the black metal scene, provided that that this is only a commentary, this is not an intervention. So from a musical perspective, from the artistic perspective of these musicians I'm interested in, I don't see them interested into the politics of necropolitics. They're more interested into the necro, in a way. And I guess this is okay for an artist, you know, because artists, not all artists, but artists in the broad sense of the word, they tend to very often tend to distance themselves, differentiate themselves from the immediate political scene of the day. But at the same time, it's also important to note that this particular scene of drone and doom music is one of the few scenes in subcultural life and music that is actually giving some commentary on these issues, even if it's a passive, fatalistic resignation. So, if you go into the world of heavy metal or rock music in general, there could be, of course, there is of course interesting social political topics there. But it's either very superficial or it's on a level which for me is not interesting. You know, it's a combination of entertainment and social commentary, and I guess this is just very subjective. I don't need the entertainment part.